Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. We have a Patreon page now if you want to support the podcast coming out every week. The Patreon page is Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/Willosophy, W-I-L-O-S-O-P-H-Y, patreon.com/Willosophy. You can join for as little as a dollar a month to help support this podcast and make sure that James Fosdyke, who does all the original artwork for the episodes, get paid, and podcast Mike, who helps me coordinate everything, and Mike Hell, our US-based producer who weaves it all together. So to make sure that all those guys get paid for the podcast, it helps for your contributions. We have the occasional ad, which Charlie helps me out with, but your Patreon support is really what keeps this podcast coming out on a weekly basis. So thank you very much for those who've joined up already. If you would like to join up, that would be massively appreciated. And obviously, if you can't afford to join up, then those who are contributing to the Patreon, thank you from me, but also thank you that you can access this podcast for free if that is all you can afford. I hope you are still enjoying it. I would ask, if you do enjoy the podcast and you can't afford to contribute to the Patreon, spread the word. Send out a tweet, put it on your Instagram, share it around on your social medias, wherever you live, or just recommend it to somebody. Maybe there's an episode like the Wayne Schwoss episode or the Craig Coombs episode, Clementine Ford, something that you feel like specifically refers to someone, would be interesting to someone. Pass it on. Spread it around. We don't have a media organization or anything behind us to run ads or promote the podcast. We're not part of a big network or anything like that. So mostly people find out about the podcast through word of mouth. So spread it around, rate it, review it, support it. Thank you very much. Ronnie Cheng's a superstar, hey? If you don't know Ronnie, then what are you doing? Ronnie Cheng is one of the most brilliant emerging superstar comedians in the world. He's on The Daily Show, of course, in the US. He had his own show, Ronnie Cheng's International Student, on the ABC. He was the only ever live version of this podcast that we've done, I did with Ronnie. And so I'm not sure this is a podcast that suits the live. Although Ronnie was brilliant in that episode, and please go back and listen to it. There's just something about the intimacy of these conversations that putting them in front of a crowd changes the dynamic of. And even though I loved everybody who came to that show, and Ronnie was so brilliant on that show, I just, for whatever reason, feel like that's not the correct format for the show. Who knows? Maybe in the future we'll find a way to do it live, because we certainly do get a lot of requests from people for that. But at the moment, it's just not something that I'm looking to do. I like the podcast how it is. There's been offers to film it. I don't want to film it. I think that changes the dynamic of the conversations as well. So at the moment, it just pretty much exists like this, a little conversation in your ears, and I hope you enjoy it. So I was really pleased to have Ronnie back to come to my house and, do a proper intimate one, the other end of the spectrum. So Ronnie was back in Australia a few months ago now. It's probably 3 months ago now, just to put this conversation in context for time and space. But loved having Ronnie on the show. We'd happily check in with Ronnie every 6 months, because we always get to the end and have a bunch of other things that we were going to talk about that we never got to. So we will do that again, I'm sure. This will be an ongoing conversation with Ronnie as he dominates the world more and more. He's a brilliant guy, and I'm always appreciative that he takes the time out of his schedule to come and have a chat with me. So enjoy this episode with Ronnie Cheng. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Return guest on Willosophy. It doesn't happen that often, a return guest on Willosophy, but I promise it. I promise it all the time. And then I rarely get the opportunity to reconnect with somebody. But I was particularly looking forward to this because today's guest is rarely in the country. So it's a good opportunity to grab this person while they're, here. Many of the other people who are here all the time, I'm like, I can grab them all the time, so then I don't grab them. whereas there is some advantage of flying into a country and being
there is some people
special.
Like you more. People like
I
you
should
more.
Ask who you are. Who are you?
Oh, this is Ryan Cheng. Thanks for having me back on.
Now we can jump back into it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Again.
There is something I used to notice this about America, mm-hmm. which was like I would be in LA maybe 3 months of the year, and then like across America the other 3 months of the year. Or maybe over in LA, maybe even 2 months.
Yeah.
So when I was in LA, people were always like, oh, was it hard to get gigs in LA?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no. I actually used to have a pretty full schedule because I was only there for 2 months.
Right.
And everybody would let you on their shows. And he's only here. Yeah. He's only here for this time.
Yeah.
We'll put him on the show.
Whereas if you live there, they'd be like, oh, we can get this guy anytime.
Yeah. You get about a month's work when you live there. you get 2 months
of work.
There's
something to that, man. There's something to when you're in town for a limited time. There's some impetus. There's some motivation. It's the same reason why it's easier to get laid when you're about to leave the country.
Oh.
Yeah, it's the same energy. It's the same, like, oh, he's leaving, then, all right.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter anymore.
This is like a freebie.
Yeah, he could suck and it's fine.
He's getting on a plane.
Yeah.
Well, the only problem is it's too good that they cancel their flight.
Then it becomes a problem.
Then it's a real bold commitment straight away. I thought it'd be nice to get you back on also, though, because I've only ever done one of these live, which was one that you did with me live. And I quite like doing that, but I'm not sure that this is the show that like necessarily adds anything from having, I'm not sure it detracts to have a live audience there, like particularly because you were a great guest because you didn't play to the audience, but there is an awareness of an audience being there.
Sure.
And I think it leads to a different conversation. And whereas this podcast, I like to have rambly, long, introspective conversations sometimes.
I love how much thought you put into just even that live audience for this podcast. Because in my head, I was like, man, this is making some money. Like, it looks like it's making money. People look like they're having fun. Like, all right, it looks like everyone won.
Maybe.
but you have this really, really good, no, it has to fit the occasion and we need the audience appropriate to the conversation. I'm like, man, people seem happy to see you and they pay money and you made money. And I was like, all right, well, that was the bottom line for me.
Now, Ronnie, I might need to ask you for career advice occasionally because I think that was the one and only time this podcast has ever made money and I've never done it again.
I'm happy to be the one that pushed this on into the black.
I do think about this podcast a bit in regards to what
presentation.
Works best.
Presentation.
Yeah, exactly. Suiting the tone. Like, I love doing TOEFOP or FOFOP or those shows live.
Yeah.
Love doing the stand-up live, but this doesn't feel necessarily like it's a live thing. So it's nice to have you back, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to have it's been a couple of years since we did that.
Yeah.
So we could kind of have a conversation about the last couple of years and you know, see what's been going on. So you're in Australia doing stand-up at the moment.
Yeah, a stand-up tour. I try to come back every 2 years. And I love stand-up, much like you, you know, draw a lot of inspiration for that love of it from you guys, the people who still do it even when you don't need to. Clearly, you've got, like, beautiful houses everywhere. And you're still on the road, you know. And I mean, physical ailments, you're still doing it because it's love of the game. It's pure love of the game. And I love it just as much. And I think it's interesting. I love it. And also, I don't want to... I'm always reluctant to come back and to have something perfect. But you know, you never have something perfect. So my wife was like, you got to book it in now because you just did the movie and, you know, it's appropriate time and you'll write the show. You know, she's always like, you'll figure it out. And at the time I'm like, you don't understand what this is. Okay. You can't just figure this stuff out. And I'm like stressing out for months, just it's weighing heavy on you, you know, which is what it's about. Right. It's like, I need to get this right. Get the show right. Write the material. So I've been working on it the last couple of months and I was touring Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney. And I'm going to Canberra next week, which this podcast probably not going to come out before then. But it's okay.
We'll give it a plug anyway.
Yeah.
Put it in time and place.
It's okay.
Here's what I'm interested in.
Please.
It's like, you talk about that idea of when somebody else, your wife in this case, often your partner, often the person who's closest to you, who sees it, offers you those words of encouragement.
Yeah.
Because you're in the depths of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you feel like, this is never going to get done.
Yeah, I ruined my career. Yeah.
And they come with the, you'll get it done. You always get it done.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just want to scream. I will not. You don't understand.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you do.
Yeah.
And they were right.
Yeah. 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 And there's something about that. There's something about having people you trust to say that, right? Because if it was someone you didn't trust, you'd be like, shut up. Like, what do you know about this? Like, don't tell me, you know. But it's someone you trust who knows you and has seen your process and, you know, and also gives the required encouragement and understanding that, you know, late night you're out trying to figure this out, you know, instead of like try not to add additional pressure to you. It helps you try to relieve the pressure with stuff. So
okay, so yeah. Tell me where you start these days with like your ideas. Like what when you say I'm going to go and do a stand-up show.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you actually start with that process now? Is it about I've already got a bit of material, you know, trotting around about this, or are you starting to go, there are these themes that are going through my mind at the moment that I really want to talk about?
Whenever I try to do smart themes, it never works out for me. It just ends up being like a boring, like rambly, like I wouldn't even tweet this, the kind of like barely
the ultimate insult. Yeah. I would not even waste a tweet on it. I would not even throw this into the toilet that is Twitter.
So
I respect my shit more than the toilet I'm about to drop it into.
Exactly, that cesspool of just the worst of humanity. I wouldn't even give them this thing. I tell you what working in America and on the Daily Show and also maturing myself a bit more, it's allowed me to kind of hit themes better than I used to when I was younger, because I think I understand a little bit more the bigger picture of like, what are you trying to say? What are you trying to say with this joke? What's your ultimate, you know, what are you trying to let people walk away with other than just laughter? You know?
Yeah, well, talk to me about that more. Why do you think that has... Like, what form does that take itself in? Is that about doing a joke and then stepping back from the joke? Or is it...
Yeah, unfortunately, I think in my case, I can't separate the race and politics from what I do. Mm. You know, because just me being on stage, I don't pat myself on the back, but I feel like me being on stage is a political statement already. Because in Australia, man, I was looking for... Asian openers, like, you know, there's my point is like there's not a lot. There's only me and Michael Hing and Aaron Chen. Sorry, I love you, Aaron Chen, and some other guys, you know, but it's not a lot. So me just being on stage doing stand up in English in you know, on these platforms, like theater platforms, it's already a statement. So I kind of have to factor that in when I'm doing stand-up in terms of like, well, what do I want people to walk away with? Because like you're not, you're kind of representing the race in some ways. And so you want to portray it in a way which, if I was watching, when I was a kid, I would want someone who was Asian to say that. I was like, oh yeah, why didn't you say that? Or like, why don't you stand up for this? Or why don't you, you know? So yeah, just that kind of stuff probably goes into it more. So
okay, that's cool. I like that a lot. Yeah, and so is that... Because it's interesting. So you talk about Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Culturally, contextually, you know, like you said, a handful of Asian comedians or prominent personalities who can, you know, so contextually here, that makes a point of difference.
Yeah.
Then you go to the US, right?
Yeah.
A bunch more, you know, Asian comedians.
Sure.
But also you're not an American Asian.
Yeah.
Like what are you?
Dude.
To them, what are you?
Oh man, that is the $1 million question. That is, and that's the thing, like we've only just started to introduce nuance into how we talk about Asian Americans or Asian people in the West. Because previously it's just like Asians. We're just Asians. Mm. And even differentiating Asian American from Asian people was already, like no one even did that. And then now we start to differentiate Asian Americans and Asian Asians. But the problem is that, you know, as well as I do, that you know, the term Asian American is, or even Asian Australian, it's like it was created to not only simplify, but create this powerful voting bloc. But in that, there's like all these different people who hate each other.
Right.
So you've got Koreans, Japanese, Burmese, Thais, Malay, Indonesians, Filipinos, then you got Chinese Filipinos, Chinese Indonesians, Chinese Malay people, Chinese Koreans, and then you've got Asian, you've got the American version of all that. You know, you got Japanese American, you got Chinese Malaysian American, you got Chinese Filipino American. So the permutations are endless, and all these groups hate each other. Well, okay, or at least these groups don't align usually. Their agendas are different.
Right.
But you try to fold them under one umbrella, just jam them in there. And I think we're only now starting to tell kind of Asian stories in the West with some nuance. And so these issues are coming out. So that's good. But, you know, some people are going like, well, why don't you represent these Indonesians in the thing? And it's like, well, those are different people. Yeah. Like we we had one movie and we, you know, we couldn't, I'm sorry, we couldn't represent every single, literally every permutation of race and ethnicity and nationality in Asia. But I think we're trying to get a broad, kind of baseline level of Asian storytelling and then add nuance to that. And that's what we do, right? We're storytellers. That's what we try to do. And so to answer your question, what do they see me as? Sometimes they see me as the enemy. Sometimes I'm the problem, you know, because I have an accent. And so they're like, oh, you're making Asian people look bad because you talk like this. And sometimes I'm the hero. I'm like, oh, you're representing Asians. You know, it's both, man. What's interesting is that like Asian Americans, they have this very much more political than Australian Asians. I think Australia, like people, like if you talk about politics too much, it's almost like you're causing trouble. I don't know if that's fair to say, but with Asian Australians, I feel like they're not super politically active in terms of pushing Asian things, because it seemed like you're like, why'd you stir the pot? You know, life is here is good. If you shut up and work, the meritocracy works to some extent. I mean, obviously you can never become prime minister. You can never become a judge or a partner at a law firm or investment banker, but you can have a really good life if you just shut up and, you know, don't cause trouble. So there's this, whereas in America, it's like, yeah, why can't I become president? Why can't I become a partner at this firm? It's unacceptable that we are born in, you know, that kind of energy. And so in Asia America, the talking about race is I think much more intense than here in Australia. And there's this contradicting agenda in Asia America, which is, are Asian Americans supposed to promote Asian culture in America, or are they supposed to promote the story of, we're not, stop calling us Asian, we're American. Don't even bring up Asia, we're American. You know, and those are contradictory philosophies in storytelling. Like, how are you going to balance both those things, you know? If you get it wrong, then you lose authenticity, or you lose relevance in actual storytelling. Because if you go too Asian, people will be like, well, what the hell is this? You know, why can't you just be American? But then if you go to American, they're like, well, why don't you rep Asian people? If you don't rep it, who's going to rep it? You know, so anyway, that's...
And you're like, well, and also I'm not American.
Yeah. I bring that up and like, yeah, I'm not American. So
you get that as well. So yeah. In a show like yours, like The Daily Show, for example,
yes, sir.
Which is a show that exists to, you know, entertain, but obviously to, you know, critique. Critique, you know, the society and the the news media and politics and these sort of things.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that, you've got Trevor, who's South African.
Yeah.
You've got you on the show. That you've got some diverse voices who have an outside experience of what it means to, what the American story means.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you find that those cultural differences meet with the people who sort of have been raised with the American context of what they are? And how does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think with almost 4 years on the show now, I have better context of what that is. And I think... one very broad aspect of it is that Trevor's less angry than a lot of Americans, because first of all, I mean, me and him were immigrants, so we're obviously there because we feel it's better than where we're from. Right. Otherwise, we wouldn't go there. So we have a sense of optimism when we're there already, and so we're less like,
I came here on purpose.
Yeah, I had choice. I had options.
I mean, I could. Yeah. I could complain, and I will, but I also chose to come here.
Yeah, exactly.
Of my own free will.
Exactly. And
for a really good job, to be honest.
Yeah.
This has been the land of opportunity for me.
Yeah.
I'm hosting The Daily Show, guys.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's exactly it. And he told me from day one, I remember Trevor told me, like, man, we came from, he came from dirt floors and no running water. He's like, ratings don't make me nervous, man. These numbers you can't show me these numbers and make me nervous. Like, I've had a harder life than this. So, and he's very positive naturally as a human being. So I think that's one of the things in America. He from day one, he told me, like, outrage is on its way out, man. Like, I know it doesn't seem like that, but in terms of comedy content, he was like, yeah, we can't do this outrage, you know, this, we're gonna what's the word? What's the word they always use on the internet? Trevor destroys.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, destroys this topic or this guy's like, yeah, we're not gonna keep doing that. It's unsustainable, and it's also not what we do. We're just gonna try to do comedy. So
well, also there's an essential falseness at the heart of you know, that, which is that every time there's one of those videos, and I know what you mean, because it's that age of the over-amplification of everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone has to be cancelled and everybody has to be destroyed. You know, that's where we're at now. Peak outrage. And comedians' jobs is not to be running with the mob, but to, you know, when the mob's... That used to be a thing that comedians did all the time, and now it's just become a thing that everybody does. You know, like when somebody died, or if like some celebrity, whatever, it used to be a bit of a, you know, who would be the first comedian to do a joke about it on stage?
Right.
But Twitter and Facebook and these things have taken all that away, because the first people to make those jokes are the 3,000 to 30,000 people who made that same joke within 24 hours on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
So if you're still playing that game,
if
you're still in that world, then you're not, you're just running with the mob. You could just be someone on Twitter. But secondly, every time you see one of those, like, you know, Trevor destroys Donald Trump, I then turn on the TV the next day and Donald Trump's still president. So I do not believe that Trevor did destroy Donald Trump.
Exactly. This idea that, you know, we fixed everything by this video and okay, it's done. Let's move on to the next issue.
It turns out that Flint still doesn't have drinkable water, guys.
Yeah. No, it doesn't matter, man. He destroyed it.
I've watched 8 videos about...
No, it doesn't matter. He destroyed the people responsible. It's over. It's done. Let's move on. Don't talk about it anymore. Don't need to donate money. We fixed it.
Do you guys have a philosophy when it comes to, like, you know, a show philosophy? Is there like a Daily Show sort of, you know, I mean, something that's you can share question. If it's not something that it and there may not be, but you know,
there is one, but I forgot it. I forgot what it was. It was, it's something like, you know, we comment on the news and I mean, Trevor has definitely made it his own. So the show's philosophy is really Trevor's outlook.
Yeah.
And he's made it his own. And in the office, I'll often go back to watch old clips of The Daily Show. And it's very interesting to see the differences, you know, in the tone. And especially, you know, John Stewart, even his show was evolving over the years, you know. And towards the end, it was probably, I mean, I loved it, but watching it, I know one of the things that John said, and this is public knowledge, that John was saying how, like, I'm paraphrasing, but I have to leave the show now because he told Trevor, like, I'm too angry, I'm too tired, I gotta go, it's, you know, and make it your own. And you watch the later seasons and you're like, oh yeah, he's, you know, it was very angry at Fox News and everything. And you watch Trevor, and Trevor's not the angry guy, you know. And I think people get angry at him for not being the angry guy, which is... ironic, but
also you should be like, wait 20 years. if I am still destroying people and none of them have been destroyed.
Yeah, but I tell you what,
that'll
man,
get me
guy,
down in a while.
This guy might be the most positive human, like, in doing the news, because like, we're talking about someone, his mom got shot in the face and he's still, you know, like, as genuinely a positive, upbeat dude. And I mean, his mom's, I don't know if anyone knows the story, spoiler alert, his mom, like, got shot and survived. And I don't know if he has any hatred in his, you know. So my point is, like, he might be the one person to get through the American news cycle and not become a jaded, angry person. Yeah.
How about you? Yeah. Like, how do you monitor that? Because one of the things that people who listen to this podcast regularly will know is that I promised myself that I would not become this person.
Yeah.
But I've 100% become this person. And I've said, but also I've become the person who says this every time I bring this up.
What?
I put this little proviso on at the start that I wasn't going to become
a Melbourne hipster.
But I took Twitter and Facebook off my phone.
Good.
Greatest thing that I've ever done in my entire life.
Yes.
Like, my attention is back. I'm
on
a whole new thing. I was just telling you, I'm sorting my books in my office because I've got a new plan to read 2 books a week for the rest of the year. I'm going to take a year. I'm going to read 100 books.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm sick of reading every day news reports and, like, updates and this getting caught up in this, like, daily news cycle.
So I'm laughing because I know exactly what,
and not reading, like, bigger, not taking a step back from the 24-hour news cycle to actually just, like, you know, really take in the world.
Yeah.
And when you have those jobs where it's your job to, like, I'm doing, you know, daily radio, so it's my job to be across everything.
Exactly.
So I need to...
look at that shit.
Yes. And it can be exhausting. So I imagine on a show like yours where you're constantly having to look through this, like, does it become... does it change your mood?
It
or perspective?
I always maintain a good comedic attitude towards things, especially lately. And I'm very happy for that. Like, basically, kind of remembering, like, I'm a comedian. We're here to make fun of all this stuff, and I have to be detached. I'm like a surgeon in the ER. Like, if I care too much about any of this, it's just gonna affect the job. So I can watch it like I'm watch. It's almost like I'm watching like a TV show. Like, oh yeah, I'm sad. Like, I can't. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get even the any internet comments directed towards me or anything. I've gotten a lot better, way better at like just seeing it as, oh, it's part of the crazy show that I'm just watching, and it's my job to like comment on this show. So I've managed to take a step back mentally. And it makes me a happier and better person, because you have to deal with that stuff all day. You don't want to become too involved, for sure. And then the other thing that I do is I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and that's been great. Meditation, and it's helped me like not. I'm telling you, man, like it's helped me like work out aggression and just have that 1 hour of meditation every day that just clears my head.
So hang on, you're doing an hour of meditation.
No. Jiu-jitsu is the meditation.
As meditation.
Yeah.
I thought you were doing like an hour of jiu-jitsu and an hour of meditation.
No.
That's a real balance.
Yeah. The jiu-jitsu is the meditation. Right. I'm telling you, man, every guy, women as well, but guys, there's something in evolution that makes us just need to kill things.
Is that right?
And Brazilian jiu-jitsu is the thing that, like, it's like the jerking off of killing people.
So.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you need sex, you joke off. If you need to kill people, you do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I don't actually kill people. I don't know if that's selling it or not. But
no, I like it. So, tell me, why Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? Why was that the one that you... Because, I mean, there's all sorts of, like,
Oh, and sorry, back on the point, before Jiu-Jitsu, before my wife tells me to shut up about Jiu-Jitsu, I won't shut up about it. But,
no.
But back on the point of the social media thing is that I think that, well, the internet is very young. Social media is even younger. We've only in 2019 start to realize that, hey, maybe this wasn't such a good idea, and what and society and ourselves were only starting to build the antibodies that are required to fight this social media. You know what I mean? Like, we're only starting to figure out, like,
but the antibodies are like almost generational, right?
Yeah.
But the speed of technology, I mean, the speed of technology increases at a rate that is well advanced of our capacity to deal with the ramifications of the speed of technology.
Yeah, the antibodies don't evolve fast enough, but they're starting to come out. I can tell like what you just described, where you're like, I'll just delete this app from my phone. It's like, yeah, that's a version of the antibody. When people are like, yeah, I don't look at Twitter, I'm like, yeah, that means you got the antibodies now. Or you look at news and you go like, this isn't real.
Yeah,
that's antibodies coming in, you know. So
I do agree with that. I do agree that people are starting to go, it's like a new toy, the internet, because I have a perspective on this, because I was 20 or so when the internet really first started, and it wasn't until my mid-20s where, you know,
full-fledged,
it was like proper internet, what we kind of think now. You know what I mean?
But not that amateur, like,
but on every level,
yeah,
like, to me, like, the capacity to look something up, you know, our ease of accessing information and what effect that has on our brains.
Yeah.
The fact that I can think of a song and I can just go over and like have that song and play that song, as opposed to when I was a teenager, where I would have to go to a record store or a CD store, or like pornography or news, any of these things. Yeah. The newspaper would come out once a day, you'd read the newspaper, but you wouldn't feel the need to have to check in on the news every half an hour. So the fact that we suddenly have, that we went from not having any of these things to suddenly having access to all of these things, and we somehow thought, oh, this will be fine. We don't have to put up any safeguards or protections to how this will affect us at all.
Exactly. And not just the sheer volume, which you're describing, but it's not even benign. Some of this stuff is designed to hack your brain to make you addicted to it. So it's not even benign or information overload. It's specific information targeted to make you addicted to looking at your stuff.
I can't believe I became addicted to this thing that some company has spent billions of dollars with all the world's greatest manipulators and technicians trying to get me addicted to.
And I mean, I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it's true, right?
No, it's
true. They're addicted to the colors. Someone told me that just turning your phone to monochrome helps with phone addiction, like just getting rid of the colors so the screen is permanently black and white.
Well, one of the first things I ever did was turn off notifications. And then what I noticed is how regularly the apps ask you if you want to turn your notifications back on.
Yeah, for sure.
You're like,
man,
I've made my choice, dude. Stop bugging. I didn't turn them off by accident.
I know. But don't you?
You know what? I'm taking you off my phone altogether. So you take
then,
that.
And then your next step will be they'll keep asking if you want to reinstall it. But like, I don't know if you've noticed. Well, I mean, whether that the antibodies are coming back in society. I mean, do you feel that a little bit? It's not great, but it's a little bit now. Like, you know,
people to fight back. I feel like people are starting to go, this has destroyed itself to the point where we need to go, I'm not sure that this world we've created. It's like any movie there is about these things, right? It's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, you think it'd be the best to be in a world that's made entirely of lollies and chocolate, but eventually, you know, you drink from a chocolate river and you drown and some Oompa Loompas dispose of your body.
It's bad. Next thing you know, and
any movie where they're like, oh, I'd love to know what everyone's thinking.
Yeah.
Well, we came up with a way to know what everyone's thinking, and it turns out, like all those movies, you don't want to know what everyone's thinking.
Yeah, it's bad, and you know that's a classic American. I know America's not the only country, but I feel with that American access, you can really see it sometimes. If you live in America long enough, I'm sure you saw it. That access when they find access, like when they find something that is good, like. They'll just blow it up. So, for example, like cheese used to be like a dessert that you have like a cube of after dinner. And it was like a treat, right? It was like almost, you know, quote unquote, best part of the meal, the most memorable. It's like, oh, we got some cheese here. Mm. And then went, you know what? Let's just take that thing and just eat the whole meal. Just keep putting on stuff. You know what I mean? And they just blow it up into this thing. And you know, it's very American. So the dopamine hit you get from the notification or like or whatever, they're like, hey, that makes people feel good. Let's just give you endless all day. And then, you know, and I think it's, you know, to apply it back to comedy, I feel like when you, there's something about people buying a ticket and showing up. And I always believe, I've been trying to put this into a joke about how like for the comedy show to be good, it needs effort from both sides. I can't just come into your house while you're in bed and go, at your easiest convenience and like just tell jokes and then get the fuck out. Like for this to have the best outcome, we both need to put in effort. You need to actually come and show up and put in some effort and invest some time and money, you know, and be in the theater. And obviously I got to fucking make sure my shit's on point and then it'll be the best outcome. But if we try to do it where it's like, oh, let's just stream your live show into my home. Every comedian is going to suck. Like, you're never going to have a good experience because it's not the ultimate. And I think people forget that they need to give a little to get some, you know, in society. I sound like an old person now. But to get something back that's good, you need to, like, give a little. You need to, like, give time or money or effort or something to get it back, right?
I think so. I mean, I like live shows a lot. And I remember we had a conversation about this, actually, about recordings of, like, because I've done a 20 somewhere less than 25,
20,000,
maybe 25. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Like a lot of like hours, you know, new hours. And I've only recorded bits and pieces along the time. Mm-hmm. And mostly that was always just because I'd prefer people to come out and see it because I think that it works best when eyes. People see it.
Yeah.
Because I think that comedy is a two-way conversation. It's a conversation between you and an audience. And it's why from night to night, the show will be different because the audience is different.
Yeah, yeah,
like, you know, and when you're at your best, it's when you're most in tune with that, you know, that audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's when the show's at its best. When you film something, right, a special, and by the nature of filming it, most people, not all, like I've seen some brilliant specials, Maria Bamford doing hers to her parents in the living room and like Harlan Williams, like, you know, out in the middle of the desert with like cameras on choppers and stuff.
It was so crazy.
People have done different things, but traditionally you'll find a big juicy room, like, you know, you film it in like some grand venue in front of an adoring crowd of your biggest fans.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all loving it.
Yeah.
And it is going that well in the room.
Yeah.
But then somebody else is going to watch it on a plane.
Yeah.
Like, you know, somebody else is literally going to be on a plane to somewhere and, you know, they're going to flick it on there and they're not in that situation.
But you can't, you know, like, sorry, you... No, but like that's true, and you can't like, and you feel And that's why after you have a killer set, you're still not happy because you're thinking about the guy in the plane who's watching it. And you're like, he wasn't here. He's not going to get it. He's going to think it sucks. Everyone's like, Will, that was awesome, man. We record. We got it on tape. It's going to be beautiful. And you're like, I don't know. Yeah. There's going to be some asshole on the plane.
Some asshole
watching,
on the plane.
Who's going to flip through it after 5 minutes. And be like, fuck, this guy sucks.
I sat next to... I'll give you two quick stories because I think you'll enjoy those.
No, please.
One was we were interviewing Russell Crowe on the radio the other day. Yeah. And Russell Crowe, out of the blue, just mentioned that he'd watched my special on the the plane, which was hilarious. But secondly...
did he like it?
Oh, yeah, apparently. Yeah. Well...
Sorry, that's rude for me to say. I mean, I just meant in the context of what we're talking about.
He said that he liked it very much. Yeah. He brought it up to say that he liked it.
Yeah, it was good, yeah.
But then he did this thing, which I should not take any pleasure out of, but it gave me a small amount of pleasure, I guess, because there was a whole bunch of stand-up specials.
Yeah.
And he said, I watched all the others, got 5 minutes in, didn't watch anymore. Yeah. Watch your whole one. And I was like, yeah.
Of course.
It makes me feel better that he rejected other comedians.
No, but that's legit. And I hear that he's a big comedy fan.
He is. Yeah. And, but the other one was I sat next to a guy on a plane who was watching my special. So, and he did not know that I was sitting next to him. Like, I had a cap on, like, sunglasses, like, beard, and he just hadn't clocked that it was me.
Yeah, yeah.
And he sat there and he watched the entire special, yes, which was good. Did not laugh once. But he watched the whole thing.
No, but you don't, you know, comedy. You're not going to watch the whole thing if you don't think it's funny.
No, that's what I tried to convince myself. Yeah. It's like he's just one of those guys who laughs on the inside.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fine.
You watched it, and did you tell him at the end?
No.
No, you didn't say like...
If he'd laughed, I would have. If he laughed, I would have been like, hey, it's me, look.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was a bit worried that he'd be like, that wasn't very funny.
Yeah.
And I watched the whole thing.
I made sure I had enough to form a judgment. I watched the whole thing.
You talked about feedback and getting a little bit better at laughing off feedback.
Yeah,
or,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
taking it as... Yeah. Part of the cost of doing business.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to me about that.
And I think everyone, this is the thing which everyone says that they don't care what people think. But if that was true, you wouldn't even say that you don't care because you wouldn't care. You won't even say, I don't care what people say. It's like, there's stuff that happens in the world that I genuinely don't care about. And I don't spend my time saying I don't care about those things because I genuinely don't care. So my point is My point is
it's a good point. If you don't care, you don't even care to say that you don't care.
Yeah. You wouldn't. So my point is acknowledging. Step one is acknowledging that this stuff affects you and that you do care. And, you know, and then step two is step two is killing yourself so that you don't feel anything anymore. Step two is to really genuinely understand why it's affecting you and then try to not, you know, be better at dealing with it. And I was getting okay with dealing with it. Part of it is, I joked to my wife that part of dealing with shit on the internet is just becoming big enough where you have so much volume of shit that you can't actually keep up with it anymore.
Yeah.
And so you're like, oh, I came in, you know, when you have 200 followers and one person is shitting on you, that's 1 out of 200, but you got 20,000 people, whatever. It's it's a different scale. So one is just a sheer volume of stuff happening, and and yourself getting busier, you're easier to ignore it.
Well, I mean what I find amazing is the idea that how much just not so I'll give you an example. On my Facebook page, I quite often we'll post, interesting articles or whatever, recently there's a lot of stuff about, the environment, AI taking over my usual themes of things that I'm worried about.
Yeah.
And, but I just post them because I don't use Facebook barely at all, but I'll post the article and then just never think about it again.
Yeah.
And I ran into someone the other day who was like, oh God, there's always so many arguments on your Facebook page.
Oh yeah.
Every time you post something about climate change, everyone blah, 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 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just 100% didn't know it was happening.
That's hilarious.
And it was a real good example to me of if it happens without you, and it doesn't matter to you, all that arguing is happening.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't need to be involved in it.
Yeah, yeah.
I've walked away. I've gone to another room.
You've gone to another house. I agree with that. And so that's my attitude towards it now. I actually don't look at the Facebook stuff anymore. I don't look at and what's funny is my mom will actually earlier on, and even now to some extent, she would if someone said something on Facebook, she would
tell me. She was like, Ronnie, someone said this. You got to fix it. Someone's unhappy. And I was like, no, mom, I don't have to fix anything. These people are crazy. And then she's like, no, you don't understand. This person, your fan, is unhappy. I'm like, you don't understand. This that's not how this works.
I'm not a restaurant. This is not a Yelp review.
Exactly. Yeah.
Also, if you're a restaurant, that also is a terrible system.
Yeah, exactly. And so she would be like, you know, we get into a tiff about it. And she'd be like, okay, I'll never tell you again. And I'm like, yeah, don't tell me if anything happens. And then, you know, 3 weeks will go by, 4 weeks. And then she'll say, Ronnie, then she'll screenshot it and send it to my email and be like, this person said this. And I'm like, mom, you got to stop sending me this stuff. I don't want to see it. I don't need to see it. I'm telling you, these people don't know what I'm talking about. Please trust your own son more than these people. And she, you know, she wouldn't get it. And then lately, I think she's realized that, like she's like, oh, these people don't know what they're talking about, because it took her that long to build the antibodies to it, because they're not used to it, you know. And we, not only our gen, like in modern day, we are getting used to it, but because we're in the public spotlight, we have to have accelerated development of these antibodies. You talk to my mom, the baby boomers, and they're like, what is going on? They are so confused. The fake news and the freaking people arguing online and them getting angry over it. And, you know, Russian propaganda, like trying to hack people's like emotional reaction to things. And they're just not equipped to deal with it. And I watch my mom deal with it sometimes, and I laugh, because it's like watching someone just thrown into this battle that she, you know, it's like you don't understand what's going on.
It's like when there's, and I feel sorry for these people when they do this, because like there'll be some reality TV, because as comedians, right?
Yeah.
I mean, from the minute you start, you're getting negative feedback.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
as soon as you get.
And so there is a sort of building a natural herd immunity.
Yeah.
And like comedians sit around with each other, tell stories of their worst gigs, the worst thing that anybody said about them. It becomes like you do eventually build some sort of natural immunity to it.
Yeah.
But you see some reality TV star or some sports person who suddenly becomes famous, and then people are like, there's some article about people being mean to them on the internet.
Yeah.
And you just want to say to them, oh, people are just mean on the internet.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Everybody, there's not one person, like Google Malala. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, but here's the catch, is that it has to come from someone who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Because everyone will say that. And that was my earlier points. Everyone just says ignore it. But it's like, you guys don't know.
Mm.
Like my wife, you know, for years she told me to ignore it. And then one time, like after the movie came out, one person said, oh, you know, Ronnie's wife looks a little bit like Ronnie. Oh my God, she was like crying for 3 days, just inconsolable. And I was like, you are the big, and I was like, crying herself to sleep. I had to like console her every night. I was like, it's okay, you don't look like me. It's all right. You know, they didn't know what they're talking about.
Which is also
hypocritical and extremely insulting. That the thing that broke you was someone suggesting that you look a little bit like me. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry.
The worst thing in the world,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah.
To look like the person that you have chosen to spend your life with.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it was the worst. Like,
inconsolable.
How can anyone love me?
Yeah.
What?
That's exactly it. And it's funny her dealing it for it's like basically everyone can say that shit until it happens to them. And then they become the more sensitive, defensive people, because it's crazy. It's crazy. So I've gotten a lot better, like you said, natural immunity, and just realizing maturity as well. And also realizing that doesn't affect what I'm doing. And, you know, I recently had some bits where I was doing this. I did the live at the Comedy Cellar, which is a topical stand-up show. And I basically wrote.
But they put it on TV, right?
So they put it on YouTube. YouTube. Oh yeah, sorry, yeah, TV. Yep. Yeah. But I think about it as YouTube clips. The show basically exists as YouTube clips now. It's on TV, but you know.
Yeah.
And I did a topical joke about how I think it was China boycotting Dolce and Gabbana. So I just made a, you know, very, I thought it was very mild joke about how I think the joke was something about how is there an easier brand to boycott than Dolce & Gabbana?
Right, okay, yeah.
Like, turns out I've been boycotting Dolce & Gabbana. You know, like, it's like a $1,000 t-shirt. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm boycotting.
It'd be hard for me to boycott this daily staple of buying Dolce & Gabbana.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Really cut into my daily routine here. Yeah. And then, and just, like, people from China, like, not happy about it. And so the thing for me was like, oh, I get it. Like, when you make satire, you're talking about, you know, political issues, people get mad, and
that's it, and you just move on from it, you know, like, okay, and then that, you know, and they'll curse you out, but you're still doing other work. You've moved on from that. And so it's like, it's not, this isn't, people feel like if you're on the internet, that's the be all and end of your existence, that one clip. And it's like, oh, this is one thing I said. I literally wrote it that day for a topical show, and now it's on to the next thing.
I think there is some great power in that as well. Yeah, like, if once you can understand that there's power in, like, you know, that argument was happening while you'd already walked away from the computer. You're like, oh, you guys still...
Yeah.
Like, that's the one that I often find funny is, like, if you log on 24 hours or 48 hours later and there's still people arguing about something, you're like, oh, I've been out.
Yeah.
I've taken the dogs for a walk.
Yeah.
I've slept twice. I've read a book.
Yeah, I bet,
I watched Chernobyl, guys. Like,
and I've always hated that phrase, if you're doing... If you're doing something, people will hate you. That means you're doing something right. I always hated that because I always felt like it's very like, I don't know. It just sounds like fake philosophical, like
some mumbo jumbo. I'm not sure that 100% checks out, does it?
Exactly. Like, but I, what I...
You know, Adolf, it means you're just doing something right.
Exactly. But there is something about satire and stand-up comedy that is subversive. And it is supposed to, you know, have edge. And it is supposed to get some people, like, it's supposed to be edgy, and that's what good stand-up is, and that's what good comedy is, that's what good satire is. It's supposed to be cutting and, like, make you think and offend some sensibilities, you know?
Did you see any of Tom Gleason in the Logies?
I did. I love that whole thing. I love that whole thing because I'm so behind the you know, him shitting on the Australian and television entertainment industry, which I'm extremely angry about because there's so much talent here in Australia. And there's some cultural block blocking us from making good stuff. It's a real shame. It's just decision makers. I don't know, you know, this layer of decision makers that are just making the worst decisions possible.
So I've only ever been to the Logies twice in my life.
Yeah. I remember one of them.
Made a splash.
Yes.
Never went back. But I never wanted to go because I've said this often, that I individually like the people in that room. Many of them I think are delightful people. But you gather them all in a room, like in those suits, to slap each other on the back about the shitty pieces of entertainment that they each make.
Yeah.
And again, there are so many talented people in that room. Yeah. But so often in this country, talented people are forced to make unwatchable fucking shit.
Yeah.
And the things that we celebrate as the highest rating shows in the country, the Married at First Sight and all this sort of shit, is absolute, like, by the way, if people want to watch those things, nothing wrong with that. People eat McDonald's. I know exactly
what you're saying.
But you don't give McDonald's a Michelin star.
Yeah.
You go, it's McDonald's.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and exactly.
You don't give it a fucking award at the end of the year for being the best McDonald's.
And to take the analogy further, it's a real shame because we've got Michelin level produce and Michelin level chefs. But there's something.
And then we're grinding it up and making it into fucking quarter pounders.
And it's extremely frustrating. And we've seen enough. And I think we're qualified to speak about it because we've seen enough. We've been through the cycles. You way more than me. In my case, at least I've seen the cycles here. I've seen it in America, so at least there's something to compare with. And I'm like, man, the people who are making decisions is just awful. And also, we are comedians. Part of our job is to make fun of institutions.
Right.
And so we'll make, and then you're in this thing, and suddenly you're in this institution of the, you know, Logies, and I love that I try to acknowledge people, and it's hard to run an awards show. It's also hard to acknowledge Australian talent. I think in Australia, a lot of the times we downplay it. So it's nice to have a moment to celebrate it. But you know, you gotta call a spade sometimes, and be like, everyone here is celebrating this thing, but who has actually helped with the support network and infrastructure to make good stuff? You know, it's great to slap ourselves on the back, but what are we doing to make cool stuff? You know, it's just, I love how Australia's always like looking backwards with its entertainment and pointing to things that were great. And no doubt they were great, you know, all these TV shows. But it's like, that's great. And we're celebrating the 30-year anniversary of this show. But then what are we doing to make the next one? You know, no one's ever talking about that. We're always just like, oh, that was the best. You know, that was the peak of it. We should go back to that. And literally sometimes we bring it back and it's like, oh, hey, it's at it again in 2019. And it's like, well, what are we doing to make the next thing? You know, it's just sad. And
so I thought you would admire the way he went about it as well, which was when somebody, like, don't hate the player, hate the game, you know? Like, you set up the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
He went out and went, okay, well, I'm going to ruthlessly exploit these rules.
Yes.
And then in that way of saying, he goes, because I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
And I thought this would be a funny joke.
Yeah.
And the fact that people got pissed off about it was why it was great satire.
Exactly.
The fact that there were people in that room who hated him.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
fact that there's been think pieces about people going, that's why it's great.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just a wink or a nod.
Yeah,
it was genuinely pissing people off.
But for a good point as
well. But for a great
point. A good point. Yeah, not just, he wasn't doing a prank show.
No.
He wasn't throwing yogurt in people's faces on Swanson Street. It was like making a point of like what this institution is and what are we doing to make good content and, you know, in Australia. What are we doing to make good television?
What do you think the major, because you do have that perspective now. Because you've had International Student, your series that was an ABC, what was it, ABC and Comedy Central co-production?
Yeah, essentially it was ABC and Comedy Central came in after I joined the Daily Show. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think what it is there's again, I'll preface this by like there's been a lot of there's good people who are talented and who have worked hard on that scene. This isn't everybody, but generally speaking, I think in Australia there's a problem with too many fucking old people in decision-making positions who need to retire or at least, you know, stop making as many decisions. And I think that the global financial crisis in 2010 caused by baby boomers wiped out middle management. And so you have this generation, you have old people and young people, and there should have been a generation, a transitionary generation of middle-aged people to translate between the two ideas. You know, people with the experience to execute, but also the sensibilities which are young enough to make things work. And that got wiped out. And so you only have old people and young people and trying to communicate with each other, and they're speaking completely different languages. And so... if you want to get onto the specifics, I think that in Australia we don't allow authenticity in storytelling a lot. I think I think authenticity resonates, and I think instead we have we don't trust the creators to make stuff. We have the decision makers who pick people who give them opportunities, but then literally handcuff their hands behind their backs, and you can't play that game. And I'm not saying diversity for sake of diversity. I rarely believe in that. I'm saying diversity because it creates better stories, because it creates authentic stories, because that's the society that we experience today. It's a very diverse society. It's all these different ideas, and you know, there's cool stories to be told here. White people and black people and Asian people. It's not about racial quotas. I'm saying there's some cool stories out there, and I don't think Australia, I think, does a good job of ticking boxes when it comes to diversity. But diversity without authenticity is just like tokenism. You're just like, you can always point to, we got the black guy on TV. We got the Asian guy on TV. But when you're trying to tell the story, are you guys actually allowing them to tell stories? You know, and that's a different, I think that's the problem, is that the lack of authenticity in storytelling. Yeah.
So you mentioned the movie. So you did Crazy Rich Asians, which was a super, superly that's not a word. super successful movie.
Yes, sir.
Superbly successful movie.
Yeah.
Neither of those were actually the word I was looking for, but let's go with that. Anyway.
Yeah.
It was a real sort of cultural moment, it felt like.
Uh-huh.
Talk to me about what that experience was like.
Yeah. You don't edit these, right?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, I want to know what you think about it.
I mean, I can edit because if you want.
No, but... no, I don't mind. I wanted to know what you think about it, because you've been in this game so much longer, and you have a different perspective on it. And, you know, what do you think about the storytelling in Australia?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, look, I mean, one of the things that I've always had I've been very lucky. And I've been lucky to be surrounded by people who've kind of, you know... let me sort of do what it is that I wanted to do. But I've had to fight hard for that often.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, have often, and look, I'm a white straight man, you know what I mean? Yeah, the sort of, you know, generic starting position of Australian entertainment is what I am. Sure. And even I know how hard that I've had to fight for the capacity to host shows or tell stories or do what it is that I want to do in the way that I think would be best to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that itself is generational, because in the same way as I wouldn't, like when Tom Ballard was doing Tonightly, like we would talk about the show every now and again, but I would never in a million years think about telling him how he should be, how he should be doing it.
Sure, sure.
I mean, I think the one bit of advice I ever gave him was, I was like, even for me, I think you swear too much.
Oh, right.
and he didn't take that on board and just kept swearing. And I'm like, well, good. Good.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, do you. Okay. Like, I mean, I am a huge believer in giving some... I'll give you a better example. So when I was doing radio back in the day, we had Tom Gleason and who else was on it? Anyway, Tom was doing a regular segment, and he was doing it with Subby Valentine. Tom and Subby used to do things together, and they, I don't know if you know Subby, but he's a really funny New South Wales comedian.
Yeah,
and Tom and Subby used to work together.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they were doing a regular segment on our show.
Yeah.
And I started to notice that, like, Adam Spencer, and he wouldn't mind me saying this, I'm sure, started to try to give them guidance or direction for how the piece should be. And it wasn't really working for them because it wasn't where they were wanting the piece to be.
Yeah.
Now, it wasn't that Adam's idea was wrong or bad.
Yeah.
In fact, it was probably a really good idea that we should have done or that something that we could have done because it was a good Adam idea. But it wasn't right for them.
Yeah.
And I do think that, when you offer advice as a senior person, I always think it should be offer, and if it's rejected, great, walk away.
Sure.
You know, there's not enough people doing that. There's not enough people in the system who, because like you said, you want that level there of people who've got experience, who've got like, in my experience, this might work, or in my experience, this is a way to do that, right? You need that.
Yeah.
But you also need those people to have the capacity to offer that advice.
Yeah.
And then if the person making the thing goes, no, that's not going to work for what we're making,
yeah.
to go, cool,
I'll
offer the suggestion, and I walked away.
Yeah.
And secondly, you've just got to hire good people and then kind of just encourage them to do what they do.
Sure, yeah.
Because you don't know what it is that they do yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So... I think that that's the main problem.
Yeah.
I often watch these shows that are filled with talented people, all of whom, if given the same money that these shitty shows were given, would be able to make a really brilliant show.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, that's the problem.
So I feel like we just said the same thing.
Pretty much.
So we agree on the same thing. Okay. I just didn't know whether I'm being the petulant, generation where every generation hated the old people or whatever.
Well, but I also think that that's important.
Sure.
Every generation in some way should hate. You should have like a great mixture of respect for the generation before you and kind of hatred or mockery or like, like if the next generation coming through isn't looking at what the previous generation did and go, I want to do that better or I don't want to do that. Like the idea that in comedy, we have a really good example of this, which is ideas become hack.
Yeah,
they don't start as hack ideas, although I guess they can be. But like the first guy who did a routine about aeroplane food tasting bad would have been a genius.
The legend.
Because everybody was like, he's saying what we've all observed.
Yeah, yeah, he's
this
a
guy
legend.
Gets it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. The first person who pointed out that like men and women were like cats and dogs.
Yeah,
people would be like,
oh
my
God,
never thought of it like that before. Yeah, yeah, this guy is fucking great.
By a beach house in Sydney.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
You
know, they're like, hey, they should make the whole plane out of the black box.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. What a great observation. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's a good joke the first time. It becomes hack because it becomes an idea that is an idea that everybody has had, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the entertainment industry doesn't seem to... Like, we have that built into us a little bit, which is like, you know...
This is done. Let's move on.
This is done. Let's move on.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I often find in the entertainment industry, they don't have that same thing. And that
it's like,
be
that
very,
was done. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you see that eight routines about that. People seem to like routines about aeroplane food being bad.
Yeah.
Let's make an entire show about bad aeroplane food. The Australian television industry.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, and we say this, it's easier to hate on things and, you know, but we say this because it's coming from love and frustration. It's like we want, because I've seen good people, brilliant people here who are capable of making awesome things, and they often do. They often either end up making it despite the system or making it outside the system. And it's like, well, you know, what?
I mean, there are even things that aren't embraced here that... end up being like, I mean, a good example would be Josh Thomas's show, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Josh Thomas's show, which ended up, you know,
brilliant,
being a brilliant piece of television, and Please Like Me, I'm talking about, and for those who haven't seen it, and if you're in Australia, there's a big likelihood that you haven't seen it because no one watched it when it was on TV here in Australia, really, like in, you know, in what we call television ratings numbers, but it got sold overseas and it got recognized overseas and. Yeah, then it kind of got a second wind where people understood, you know, the quality of the thing that it was. But it certainly wasn't supported, you know, in a decent way the first time around.
Sure.
It was never a hit show. It had to grow into, and it was kind of like, it was lucky that it didn't get cancelled after the first season. And we never would have seen how great that show became. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think there could be 100 examples of that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a great example of it because there's a young voice, very clear vision. for everyone to be, he really executed on it. You know, I agree. Right. I mean, yeah.
Like, everyone was happy with him being a team captain. I'm talking about my generation. Yeah. But, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's a good safe space for you. You're on a, yeah, entertainment variety show. It's a panel show.
Yeah.
It's comedians playing some sort of game.
Yeah.
We love you on this.
Yeah.
Very happy to have you here. You're a superstar. Oh, what's that? You want to make this singular vision, join a drama comedy with this beautiful heart award? Fuck that,
fuck
mate.
That
fuck
shit.
That shit.
Shut the fuck up. We don't stay on the fucking panel. Stay behind the desk. Yeah, you know, that's, and it's just frustrating. Yeah, and especially when he proved himself with the show. You know,
but I use that as an example because I think that's an example of why wouldn't that be the same story? Like if you gave Aaron Chen that sort of money, or why wouldn't that be if you gave it to Becky Lucas, or if you went to the Grub podcast and you got, like, you know, Greg Larson and Ann Edmonds and Ben, and you got them all to do a sketch
Damian
show,
Power. Yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's a lot of fun people who making really cool, fun things, you know. It's just,
well, I mean, Damian Power is a good example, right?
Yeah,
like you'll see Damian Power roll into the panel and do a good into the project and do a good job or whatever,
yeah.
But you're like, seeing Damian Power on the project is like, you know, seeing Kanye do an acoustic set. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's I'm sure it's interesting, but it's not him doing what he does.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, where's the Damian Power show?
Right.
Like, what? How can Damian Power? Like, I mean, fuck, he's a white straight man. How can he?
No. Dude, I gotta tell you, I just saw him last week in LA. I literally saw him last week. We hung out and he's pitching his show to the US and he's getting good responses there. Yeah. I mean, beyond the normal cursory, like, we like you, it's actually progressing. So it's like, yeah, people have to go outside the system to do it. And there's more money out there, quite frankly, and more and better kind of creative freedom. It's not perfect, don't get me wrong. I don't want to put America on this kind of pedestal, but I think they definitely have. If nothing else, America skews very young, sometimes to its own detriment. Like, you know, sometimes there's experienced people who have legitimately awesome point of views or talent and they can't get an opportunity because they're just like too old. But the upside to that is that everything there's always very cutting edge and they're always looking to tell stories to young people, you know. And in Australia, I think we're looking in the past like a little bit too much, you know, in terms of storytelling.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because they say young people don't watch television anymore. Mm. So what ends is that we pitch things that people who still watch television.
Yeah, see. And that's and that's weird because it also here that commercial TV is commercial TV, but then the ABC is government funded. They shouldn't even care about the ratings. They should just be making culturally significant things. And why we care about who's watching it? Just make something that people with taste think is good, right? And then,
I mean, that is the argument.
Yeah.
And that'll certainly be the argument that I use when Gruen's ratings start to drop. I'll be like, this is still a very culturally significant show. Yeah, you don't understand. Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. We should finish up soon because I know that you have a...
No. You're this right?
Well, I'm going to just stop coughing for a second.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to try today.
Are you going to edit this or are we just going to...
If you keep talking, we won't edit it. Basically, that'll be the secret. If you talk...
If I keep going? Okay, so this is just Ronnie. I'm hanging out in Will's apartment right now, his house. Very beautiful house. I'm not sure if he's ever posted photos of this place, but it's got very beautiful mid-modern century furniture, a ton of cool artwork, his own... post comedy posters, which a little bit self-serving, but that's fine. It's his house.
Did you complain about something?
No. I was just describing your apartment to people who.
All I heard was, but that's fine. It's his house. Which I feel like I had some sort of criticism previous to that.
No, I just said you have a lot of your own artwork on it. Your own comedy shows.
Yes, that's true. So I'm going to have more too. So basically the plan is that in up here, so over there, those Detective Comics, you can see the Daredevil and the Avengers, the Batman. So they're all editions. Justin Hamilton got me those, and they're all from the year that I was born.
Oh wow!
So yeah,
that's cool. So, yeah. I did that, but with Reader's Digest.
Oh really?
Yeah, but I didn't frame it. I just got the Reader's Digest.
Grow up on a Reader's Digest?
Kind of, yeah, kind of. And my dad actually, he told me he grew up with it. He learned English from it. He would read Reader's Digest and learn English. So I went to his house, his childhood home, which is still in the family. His mom was living there, by the way. And I saw all these old Reader's Digest from the like 50s. And I was like, oh, what's all this stuff? He's like, oh yeah, I read all this to learn English.
I'm
like,
I remember definitely like being obsessed. My nana used to get the Reader's Digest, and I used to be obsessed with the jokes.
Yeah. How killer was Reader's Digest?
Right.
Man. And they're still going. I haven't seen it in...
Is that right?
Yeah. If you go to supermarkets, they're right next to Us Weekly and all that stuff.
You can still buy a Reader's Digest.
You can still buy a Reader's Digest. And I haven't opened one in 15 years, probably.
Well, yeah. No, yeah. It'd be like well over that for me. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So James Fosdyke does all the art for this podcast, but for my shows and stuff. And I've always hesitated having too much... Like you said, of your own posters and your own art and stuff
cool.
on the
I'm
show.
I'm just joking. It's
but
cool.
No. But I recently made the decision to go the other way. I was like, you know what?
Celebrate.
I'm going to celebrate. Yeah. He's done so much cool stuff. So I've got a pile of posters and stuff here that I'm going to get framed. And I'm actually going to make like this whole office space. So I'm going to try to cover like the walls and stuff. Like one of those old school... Yeah, comedy clubs.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
with all the kind of like posters and stuff just all over the world. Because this is where I work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kind of like it. I think it's nice. He's made all this cool stuff. And
you know, it is beautiful. And you've done some real landmark stuff. And so I feel the same way sometimes. There's like posters where I'm like, oh, why would I put this in my home? And then I'm like, well, you know what? This is the show that kind of helped me become a professional and do this full time. Like, why wouldn't I celebrate that in my own home? Like, why am I complaining to myself about my own stuff in my own home?
We were looking at some posters from like Meltdown and Hot Tub and some US shows that have their own posters that I have here.
Do you have a box of memorabilia?
I only kept like the first few shows that I did, like, you know, that I thought were, fun, cool shows. I just kept those. Like, it's not, I don't have a heap of my own stuff. In fact, James's stuff is the only ones that I really
so
have.
So you never go through and see the old Melbourne Comedy Festival like catalogs and
no.
You don't keep that?
No, wow. I don't.
Yeah.
No, in fact, I've never really been a collector of any of my stuff.
Right.
It's only recently that I've just like literally I've started to go, oh, maybe it'd be nice.
Right.
But mostly just because James has all this cool stuff.
Right.
So pretty much it's like just, before
you're
James
fan. Yeah.
Before James, nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But post James, I'm quite well.
That's cool stuff, man. Sometimes I go around like country Australia, like I did the roadshow tour, and I'm going around, and there's like people signing on the walls, you know, Maria Franklin, Keith Robinson, you obviously, and I always take photos of it. So I have in my photo album, I have all these photos of like signatures, and sometimes when I meet up now, I'll show them, like, hey, you remember you did this gig? You signed this wall. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Yeah.
So Keith Robinson, a very famous New York comedian. Yeah. For there might be some people that don't know Keith's name. He's one of those legendary sort of comedians.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
he
did the first ever Melbourne International Comedy Festival roadshow.
Yeah, I didn't know.
And so Ross Noble was the headliner for half of it, because back in those days, they didn't split it off into sort of little posses. It was one big thing. And some of the comedians did all of it.
Yeah.
And then some kind of like, you know, patched in for weeks. So I think it was like 6 or 7 weeks. So it was long.
It was long.
And so Keith Robinson was the headliner for the first half and Ross Noble was the headliner for the second half.
Yeah.
And so very cool, you know, lineup of people. And one of the first ever gigs. So this was very young in my comedy career. It was one of the, you know, first really cool things that I got to do.
Yeah.
Would have been 1997, 98, something like that. Anyway, a long time ago.
Yeah.
And one of the first gigs, if not the first gig on the tour, was Sale, where I'm from. Well, where I went to school in Sale. And so I was like, I think I was like first on. I wasn't hosting, but I was like first on. And so I came out and, you know, did a bit about like, you know, I'm from here, right?
Yeah.
And then whoever was on next, whether it was Hallier or whoever else, like came out and they started with a bit of like, oh, I'm also from here because it had gone so well. And then, anyway, Keith Robinson, who could not be more, like, so imagine that, you know, just at his prime to cocky American
Philadelphia
black man,
right? Yeah.
And that's important to the story because he struts out on stage like that in Sale and just opens with, "Good to be home." And anyway, that became our running joke for the entire thing,
yeah, yeah.
Where one of us would pretend that we were from the place that we were performing in that night. And then so Keith could basically do his "Good to be home" at the end of every show.
So you actually toured with him on that show?
Yeah, so for 3 weeks, first 3 weeks toured with Keith.
Cool, yeah, you might, I mean, make you happy to know that. First time I met him, I told him I was from Australia. He said, "Oh, Peter Heller's my guy." He's like still good friends with me.
Yeah, they kept in really good touch.
Yeah. So I mean, that's super cool. But my point to all this is that there's really cool history in the performing live comedy. And I never because I try to be a minimalist with my stuff. But if something does pass through me, I won't go look for it. But if let's say a catalog comes in my possession or like a tour pass, I'll just keep it and put it in a top end. I mean, to be fair, I don't even have. It's like half of a IKEA plastic tub. That's my whole, you know, in 9 years of 10 years of comedy memorabilia. But sometimes you look through it, you're like, oh my god, I got the, I have the run list of from like my second gig, or like, you know, I've got this something that has my name on it, flyer from this gig in Wodonga, Albury Wodonga. Yeah, it's like cool to look through it sometimes.
Sometimes somebody will send me something, you know, like somebody will stumble upon some old
That's
article
me.
Or some old thing.
That's me. I'll see. I'll take a photo. I usually send it to the people. Yeah.
So then there is that. What is your favorite? Do you have a favorite comedy moment that comes to mind? Like something that, you know, that comedy, particularly, I guess, live comedy more than, you know, say the movie or the TV show. Is there like a favorite, you know, moment that you've had comedically?
I've been lucky. I've had a lot of cool opportunities, you know, a lot of fun stuff. But whenever I'm in the moment, I always try to be like, oh, this doesn't mean anything. And just to, you know, like keep my expectations low. But I think one thing that stands out was actually I was at the Cellar performing for maybe the third time or fourth time. And I remember having a moment of pure just like so in the present that it was borderline enlightening of like, oh, I'm just here in the show doing the show. I really love doing this. I could probably do this the rest of my life. I'll be happy. Up to that point, there's always like 1 foot out the door. Like, when's this gonna end? And I guess in that performing in that moment, there was this thing of like, oh yeah, even if it ends, it's fine. I still love doing this. You know, I'll take it. Like if it ends, just manage to get up to this point and I'm fine, you know?
Yeah. You'll go from when's it going to end at the start, and then you get to a point about, you know, when you're 25 years old, and you go, when is it going to end?
I look forward to that. Yeah. I remember, the Cellar, and not because, you know, the Cellar is what, you know, we put on a pedestal as we should. It's a great gig. But it was more just that it's something about performing live in that moment. I was like, oh yeah, this is fun. You know, like, there's no TV cameras, and it's just one of those nights that will pass in people's memories.
Yeah, but that's I understand that because that's like, you know, the Cellar is a proper like comedy gig that, you know, played by good people. It's you know, it feels like if I can do it here, I could probably do it anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. There's still magic in there, you know, and people want to be there.
Right.
Which is not always the case at comedy shows. And so that was probably the moment that stands out of everything, you know. I was really lucky. I did Fallon about a few weeks, a month or two ago, you know, and that was really fun. That was also a little surreal.
So did you do stand-up or desk stand-up or both?
So I did the... I was a guest on Colbert, and that was super fun, and it was a real honor to do it, and it was exciting. But then I did stand up on Fallon, and like, I don't know, for some reason, stand up is like seen as like lesser than being a guest on that thing. So it's almost like, you know, I'm not saying I felt this way. I mean, like, traditionally it's like a step down. They're like, don't do stand-up after you be a guest, because you're never going to get back to being a guest or something. And I was just like, you know what? I just love doing stand-up. I've never done stand-up on a late-night show. Let me go do this thing.
Well, also, that's one of the things, like, I have mixed feelings about Jerry Seinfeld. We don't have time to get into them. But one of the things that I do love about Jerry Seinfeld is that he kind of, like, when he does those Tonight Shows, he'll go out and he'll do his stand-up first.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's like, no, no, no. I'm a stand-up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Love of a game.
I want to come and do stand-up.
Yeah, he loves
the game. So I'll do my stand-up, and then I'll come over and talk to you.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do my stand-up first.
Yeah, and if you... I don't know. I don't know him. I don't want to pretend to know him that well. But like, I feel like if you asked him to choose, he'd probably be like, "I'll just do stand up."
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to. So anyway, yeah, I did it, and it was like one of those like show busy moments where it's like, "Oh yeah, it's cool." You know, dress up, you come out, try not to be too stiff. You've done something you've done a fucking million times, but for some reason, in that moment, you're like losing your mind because the adrenaline's going. You know, and
Where are you? So when you do Fallon, Where is the stand-up spot? Is it a good spot in relation to the audience?
Yeah, it's it's good. It's good. It's a good spot. It's far away. But there is a distance between you and the crowd, but because they're so amped up that it doesn't matter. And they just want you to give them something to laugh at. And if you give them something, they'll go for it. And also, one thing I realized on the day was I had some friends. I watched other people's clips just to get an idea of it, and I noticed one of my good friends, Nathan McIntosh, super funny comedian, he didn't use a microphone. And I asked him, like, "Well, what was that about? Did you, you know, because, you know, we without a microphone, it's literally when we do our reps, we train with the microphone. It'll be like running without shoes or something at a 100-meter race." And so he just said, "Oh yeah, I just realized that, like, if I use the microphone, it blocks my face and I become very closed. So I just didn't use the microphone." And I said, "Oh, maybe I should do that." So then on the day, I go like, "Oh hey, by the way, I think I just won't use the microphone." And the producer was a little freaked out. He was a bit like, "Have you done it without microphone before?" I'm like, "No, I haven't, but I think it'll be okay." And he's like, "Are you sure?" And he was like, and to be honest, I wasn't completely sure, but I also felt like, yeah, I think I can do it on microphone. Like, I can freaking walk and talk. I'm an adult. You know, like, I've been doing this a while now. I'm still learning how to do it, but I think I can do it on microphone. And so I did it on microphone. Oh, best decision. Just that small thing. It became like, instead of like, "Here comes the clown," it's like, "Everybody shut up. This is an important announcement to make." And then you just go for it, you know? Like, it becomes like a different thing. And you open up a bit more. You're not like this.
Because I use my microphone only in a stand now. Like, yeah. You never take the microphone out of the stand anymore. And I like the stand, like in live gigs, I like the stand as well. Like, I like to be able to touch the stand and move it, like to use it as like part of the energy of the show, right? But I think in one of those spots, yeah, absolutely. Why would I hate when I'm at a corporate gig or whatever, and like they're like, "Oh no, we don't have a stand. You have to hold the microphone." I'm like, "Oh, I am unused to this. I use both of my hands now."
Yeah.
Or one of them has a drink or something.
It's part of your timing. It's part of your timing. It's like Chappelle and cigarettes.
Right.
The cigarette is part of the timing of the thing. Like, when he didn't have one, he was still touching his mouth because he's, you know, he's special.
Well, that was like in Australia, you know, they just paid the fines everywhere.
Yeah, I know.
They were like, "Oh, you can't smoke at, you know, the Opera House or whatever. It's like $30,000 fine." And he's like,
"All right."
Or it's what we call a $30,000 cost of doing business.
It's the business class tickets and the smoking fine.
I want to smoke my cigarettes. This is part of the show.
He makes it work. So your mic stand is part of the timing. And it was interesting doing it that way.
So what is the day like when you're doing this? Because you've done stand-up on TV before. But talk me through... How does that, have you like put together a set in advance that they've been watching and they've been seeing you run?
Yeah, so I got to tell you, it actually became pretty routine. And if I can be real about it, I wanted to do the late night set because it felt like a milestone. It's also fun to do, and you know, we do stand up. That's one of the things that it's like it's a cool milestone. So I've been trying to get on it, and I could never get on it, and I kind of gave up a little bit on doing it. Because I did the Live at the Cellar thing. I told you that about the joke about Dolce & Gabbana, and it got so many hits. And it came straight from my brain. It was so raw, unfiltered, and it hit. And I was like, you know what? 2019, this is it now. You know, this is what it is now. It's not the Tonight Show spots. It's this stuff. And so I just mentally kind of went like, okay. And you know, the way the universe works is the moment you don't care about something, then it starts coming. And it's like, yo, when are you going to do it? When are you going to submit the set? The booker came to watch my 1 hour show at New York. He very kindly watched the whole thing. I didn't even know he was there. He's like, yo, you got to come on the show, you know, send me a set. And in my head, I was like, well, I'll send a set. They're gonna, you know, change all this stuff. And I sent it anyway, and they didn't change anything. And I was surprised because I submitted quite a political set that, you know, was talking about white people, black people, and Asian people, and they didn't change a single word. And so I was like, okay, well, let's do it. I guess it's happening. So this is maybe, you know, like 2 months out. And so the next 2 months I working the set, but I didn't do it like the way Americans would do it, where it's like every night I'm going to do this set 5 times a night. And then the next I'm going to repeat, I'm going to do this set. I didn't do that just because I have 15 minute spots anyway. So it's not, you know, I don't have short spots. And I just don't like that robotic whatever. So I just did my usual sets, you know. I didn't over rehearse it. And then on the day, it became so routine. It was like, go to 30 Rock, you show up, they have a driver drive you to the building, you go up and then you sit in a green room, then agents you've never met come in, and then people who represent you who you've never seen before come in, and then apparently you're the most awesome thing. And then I'm just sitting there. We went through the rehearsal. The call time was probably around like 4 or 5. And the Daily Show gave me the day off to do it, which is cool. And then we just sat there. I remember it being pretty chill. Agent, and then it was just me. I didn't have like an entourage. It was me and this other guy who I don't know, and then me. And the agent, and we were there for about 2 hours, which by showbiz standards is a very short wait. So you're not like in your own head hyping yourself up, and you go out there and you perform it. And I gotta admit, the performance itself is a blur because there's so much adrenaline going on. And then afterwards, me and my agent just went to like this Japanese curry place. It's like very routine. Yeah. Like, it was very routine. It was like nothing. We didn't make a big deal about it. And so I kind of like it that way, you know.
And what about when you do Colbert's show? Because yeah. I mean, like you're talking yeah. about, I mean, Stephen Colbert, firstly, just yeah. like such a relentless yeah, intellectual yeah. and comedic force of yeah. nature, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But also exactly. like a previous Daily Show alumni. Yeah. So I assume like yeah, has yeah. some sort of, you know, affection for yeah. you know, what the show is now. And, yeah, you know, you're walking into, you know, this is a guy who essentially, yeah, was doing, like, you know, you're doing bits on the Daily Show.
Yeah, he's the co-creator of American Satire.
Right.
Yeah. Colbert, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. right. yeah. So what is that experience like yeah, when you go to do that?
So I was cool. You know, everyone at the Daily Show who worked with him is kind of actually still on the show.
Right.
So I asked them the EPs and all, what's he like? And, you know, everyone said he's the nicest guy on the planet. And so I took the interview segment very seriously. Like I planned for it the way I would plan a stand-up set, because I know like you want to make good TV, I'm not good enough to wing it. So I just had some bits written out, and the producer approved them. And so I put work into the interview so that it wouldn't suck, or at least I hope it didn't suck. And so I show up on a day, and then I meet him just before we go on, and he's super friendly. He's like, I'm gonna end you tonight. This is the end of it. You've had a good run for too long. This is it. And then I say, you know what? I'm super tired. I hope you end it because I'm so sick of doing this stuff. Please, I told Colbert to end my career. And then we.
But also, that's a great. What a.
That's the first thing he said.
What a great comedic way of, like, you know, helping people. Yeah. To me, that is like that's respect.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
if
yeah.
he says that to you in that way,
yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
him saying, I have full confidence that you won't fuck it up tonight.
That's what I thought like, as well, know. Yeah. That's the first thing he said to me. He comes in to make up and goes, Ronnie, I'm ending it tonight. Your career's over. You've had a good run for too long. And then, and so then we go onto the stage, and he's super welcoming. And what happened was that I had 2 stories that involved him personally, which was cool. So one was I had a list of, there's this list of like tips for correspondence that he came up with. He passed to Rob Riggle, who passed it to Al Madrigal, who passed it to Jordan Klepper, who passed it to me. It's this email chain of tips. And so I brought it on set with him. I was like, hey, do you know about these tips? And he's like, I heard about this. I've never seen it though. And then I showed him, and then he was like, oh yeah, this is, you know, this is right. We were joking about the list, and then it got cut from a program. But it was cool that we had that, you know, that Daily Show thing. It's like the letter that presidents write. to each other. You know? I mean, that's pretty cool. You can't get more personal than that.
That is amazing.
Yeah,
but also to kind of follow that chain too.
Yeah, yeah. And then the second thing was, what happened was he broke his arm during a live taping of the Colbert Report, and he for months he had this bit about wearing this red color Colbert wrist strong. It's like the Lance Armstrong thing, but it was the Colbert one. And he would give them out in the crowd, and the instructions were to give it to someone more famous than them. And it kept getting passed around. He said, hopefully it'll get to the president or get back to me or something. And then I did a show in Boston. The night Trump got elected, I was doing a show in Boston. And the show went well, I think. And then after the show, this Asian guy gives me the wristband. He goes, like, Colbert, I got this from Colbert. He said to give it to someone more famous. So I'm giving it to you. And I hope you can give it to Colbert one day. And this was like, 2016, like way before I even was any chance of getting on this kind of stuff. And so I just kept it for 2 years in my memorabilia box. That's why you got to have a memorabilia box, man. I just kept it in there. And then when I booked Colbert, I was like, oh, crap, I can finally do this. And I like dug around and I couldn't find it. And then I was asking my wife, like, where the hell is it? And she was like, I don't know what you mean. What was it? It's this red thing. It looks like a rubber band. And she's like, oh, I think it's in the rubber band, it's in the rubber band box of rubber bands that we throw away regularly. And I was like, we almost throw away the freaking Colbert wristband thing. And anyway, so I took the wristband, gave it to him on camera. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Okay.
Yeah. So that was fun. So once you have those two personal stories, it's like, it's so specific and fun. And yeah, so that's what we played off of. So.
And the movie, because we mentioned the movie then we didn't get to talk about it. So Crazy Rich Asians was huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it was massive, right?
I hope so, yeah.
I think it was. I think it was really huge. Fair to say, are they making another one?
I think so. I think they're going to make... this is stuff that's on Google. Yeah. So, I mean, Google knows more about it than I do. I think they're going to try to do 2 and 3 back to back. I think that's what I heard. But honestly, I haven't heard anything about it.
Yeah.
If I was a gambling man, I would bet that they would make it because the first one made so much money. And then there's like 2 other books,
right.
3 books total. But I don't even think they're going to follow the books. But that's just my speculation, because it's a interesting story to tell. The fact that they managed to tell the first... It's written like there's so many different perspectives and so much going on that we filmed so many set pieces, expensive set pieces that barely made the movie just because it would become a 4-hour movie.
Right.
Like, there was so much stuff to put in there. Yeah.
Well, maybe they should just go, the second one's coming out. It's just the bits we've cut out of the first one.
They could do that. Yeah. They could actually do a director's cut. I think it was a director's cut. So I don't know what... There's this bonus scenes I hear on the DVD, which I haven't seen yet. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that they'll make the movie. But I would bet that they would make a second one or third one. What it is, I have no idea. But
So acting is obviously something that... I mean, you've acted in your own things. Now you're acting in other people's things.
Yeah.
Like acting, comedy. Like what... I mean... What is the next sort of, 12 months, for you?
I'm hoping to, I'm trying to get a little bit more into acting. I really like it. I love that it's acting for me. It feels like, I always feel like good comedy should be a distraction from reality.
Mm-hmm.
And acting in stories, I feel is a distraction as opposed to like telling everyone what's wrong with them. All the time, it's like giving some people like an escape from the whatever the problems are. So that's why I like it more than, let's say, like a political talk show where we're discussing all the crap that's happening in the world.
It's like escape from that rather than
dwelling in it.
Rather than you're already living this, and now I'm going to tell you why you're fucking it up. Thanks for tuning in.
There's something weird about that. So I always like the acting and storytelling, and I feel like that's. It's an easier form of comedy because it's not that I'm going for easy laughs, but I'm just saying that I have more affinity with like comedic storytelling and sketch than I do with like a talk show panel, that kind of environment. So
also, the idea of an easy laugh is underrated. I mean, the amount of times I've put hard work into something that has got no laugh, where I would have very much settled for it. That was a difficult no laugh. I'll take an easy laugh every day.
Sure. And like you spend whatever hours crafting a bit, and then you come something off the top of your head that gets a way bigger reaction, and you're like, oh, "Fuck, what did I do all that for?"
I'm thinking about. Tell me if you think I'm bananas, but So next year at the Comedy Festival, I'm thinking about, because I've done, so in Sydney,
you're thinking about doing a show. Let me
think about doing a show. Well, weirdly enough, I'm thinking about for the first time ever not writing a new show. But I will explain to you why. So for a few years in Sydney, they started as little workshoppy shows, but they became... So I do these shows called What You Talking About, Will, which are my improvised stand-up shows,
right?
Yeah. So they're completely different every night. They originally were just like ways for me to come up with material, but they've developed into something else, which was I barely ever get any material out of them anymore. But to do them well, you just make them about that night. You know, what's in the air that night, talk to the crowd, talk in what's your head, what you did that day, whatever. Yeah, like,
you're so crazy.
And you make a show. And I find them very exciting to do. Mm-hmm. And this year at the festival, the first 15, 20 minutes some nights was just like audience stuff. Mm. And there was just a bit of me that was like, maybe I want to do a year where I just like literally do an improvised show every night. Uh-huh. So maybe only 10 shows. I don't think I could do a whole festival. It just, it's more exhausting than doing,
you're so crazy.
But that's what I'm thinking about doing. I'm thinking about doing a completely improvised show.
Well, like you already do that. As in, it's... You already know how to do that. You've been doing it.
I know, but taking it to the festival and like, you know, taking it to it, like, go, this is my show.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I'm doing this year.
Yeah.
Is the show is,
yeah,
come along. It could be like, I don't think it would be shit. I think I've done it enough now that I,
yeah,
like, it would be good.
But more importantly, it feels like something that you know, in your pursuit of the next thing. It feels unnatural.
That's the main reason. I keep bringing it up because I'm trying to justify it in some broad context rather than, you know when you've already made the decision of what you're doing and then you try to essentially what I'm trying to do is put in all these like steps and people go, oh yeah, he's really thought this through. Yeah, yeah. Whereas I've already clearly decided that is what I'm doing.
You're going to do that? Yeah.
Yeah, because it is. It scares me a little still. Like it terrifies me, that idea. And I think that what I also want is to... I think that when I'm on stage in that moment, I have no time to lie.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know how often, like, you know, our routines
comes up. Yeah, yeah.
Become, you talk about authenticity.
Yeah, yeah.
And the gap between, in comedy often it becomes that moment of creation is authentic.
Yeah.
But the moment of recreation,
yeah,
when you then have to do it again, you lose a little of the authenticity because you're trying to recreate a moment rather than be in the moment in the first place.
Yes.
And so I think that I will learn more about my stand-up and what sort of stand-up I could be.
You try to learn about it yourself. Yes. That's crazy to me that you're already, you know. But no, I think it's a great, as in you're already so accomplished, I can't imagine want to learn it. But it sounds like it's a great idea. And you know, your fans will buy any bullshit you put out there. So
thank you. Thank you, Ronnie. That's what I wanted to hear. Thank you to my fans who will buy any bullshit that I put out there.
The fact that you have so much nuance behind all your shows, you're like, well, you see, this podcast is about this. But then that podcast is actually about this. And this podcast started as that, but then it became its own thing. It's just different vibe. I'm just creating different rooms in my house. And I'm like... Yo, how much shit are you selling that everyone is buying all this stuff and you're still trying to create different brands?
Amazing. I like to individually curate.
Yeah, you do.
Things,
and right? It's great because
my little, as I like to joke about them, I have my little projects.
Yeah.
I just have my little projects. Dude,
you'll never say this and you don't need to agree with me because you're too humble to say it, but you are probably the last Australian folk hero. You're the last one. You're going around, you're the last one, or at least you're the current one. Because you're going around, you're making all this content, everyone listens to you, you're speaking relevant points, you're speaking to everybody, you know, you're the, I don't want to be insulting by comparing you to Chappelle because it implies that you even need that comparison, but you're on that level of speaking to society and you're putting out so much stuff every year that's relevant and funny and people can watch you, you know, you are the last Australian folk hero. Who else is there? Who else is there? You're it. You're Banjo Peterson, man. You're the guy, man. Who else is there? There's talented comics, no doubt. But there's no one going around, you know, and just being so authentic, raw, and relatable, and like, you know, the voice of the times, and yeah.
Well, I can't agree or disagree with any of that. I will leave that. I'll take that as a comment, as Tony Jones would say on Q&A. Ronnie, thank you for squeezing this in. I should say to people that you're on tour here in Australia, and you're really flat out, and you still manage to make the time to come and do
anything,
this.
So anything.
I, uh, I genuinely appreciate that.
No, of course, anything for. I remember I was starting out, and you helped a lot of comics, but you also helped me. Not that that is the reason why I'm doing. I'm just saying that it. You know, I really appreciate all the guidance when I was first starting out. In fact, when I was first moving to America, I remember you making the time in your glorious Sydney mansion to, in between lying around that you
don't tell people about all my success. No, it's a beautiful house. It's much harder to get them to contribute to the Patreon for the podcast.
It looks like that five podcast I just really paid off. But I say that, but only it's a beautiful house. I don't mean to imply that, you know, you whatever. But it was very nice that you. Yeah, I remember asking, picking your brains about moving to America, and you gave, you know. You always gave your time, not just in that instance, and you really promoted me and other comics, you know, when we were starting out in comedy. So, yeah, anything, Will, anytime. Okay. Thanks for having me on this podcast. We're honored to...
So, what can people watch out for? Give some plugs.
I don't know. I don't even know. Daily Show. I guess I still do stand-up. I got some cool stuff coming up, movie and special-wise. So, that would be cool. You know?
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So people that. Watch out for those
things.
All right, so nice one. Well, thank you, my friend. It was a great pleasure to catch up with you.
Thank you.